Hello, this is Noah Gibb with Computer Science, Just the Useless. I'm here today with Ross Coffin, engineer at Stitch Fix, as well as being a former teacher. He's here to talk about that thing we talk about. So Ross, tell me a little about how you learned to write software.
Well, let's see. It goes way back to my very first day as a teacher. So this is me right out of college. I had background, majored in sciences in college, not much computer background per se. This is right around the time of the first internet boom. So computers were sort of in the background, but not really of great interest. The very first day of school, the head of the science department, and this is an eighth grade class that I was teaching, the head of the science department handed me a box of Legos that had a computer element to them. It's called Lego Mindstorms. And I thought this was the coolest thing ever. So I ended up starting an after-school club alongside of teaching my normal classes. I was learning how to use and program this microcontroller that came with the Lego kits and attached motors. And we would, figure out how to attach sensors and navigate mazes or respond to environments or play, pre-programmed robot games and entered competitions. And this became something that was a really fun part of my teaching experience. I realized through the process of learning how to write these basic programs, I really enjoyed programming myself. And after my time in teaching sort of came to an end, I wanted to see what it would look like to have a career in technology. There was no boot camps around at this time, and I wasn't quite sure what would be my step into the programming field, not knowing much about software engineering, but having a real curiosity about programming in general. And having been exposed to little things like HTML, putting up some of our robot success stories on basic school website pages. And I somehow conned my way into a technology job and thought that I needed to get ahead a little bit. So I wasn't writing programs on a daily basis, but I was providing some of my educational expertise to a publishing company. But at night, I ended up entering a master's program in computer science, thinking this was how I was going to have be able to join the very smart programmers in my company. And before I even finished my degree, it was a part-time thing, and while I was working full-time, I managed to land my first software engineering job. And I really think that it was maybe a few semesters into my program, a lot sooner than I anticipated, but I really think that demonstrating that I was able to A, get into a program, and B, show some success and some learning through that process was a way for me to get my foot in the door and make that transition. I did end up completing my degree, even though, the main reason I went into the program was to see if I could land a job. I ended up getting really interested in some of the subjects that I was learning and wanted to complete and wanted to finish what I started. I would say that I am very proud of the fact that I completed that program, and just generally, and I think that's a good sort of starting point for today is, I sometimes wonder and continue to wonder what are the practical things that I got out of that experience. And, the answers aren't always so clear.
So where did you go for the master's? What school?
So I was in New York City at the time. I started my first few semesters at a community college. It's called Pace University. And then I transferred into the NYU program, which was, fairly well known. And there's some a pretty established professors there. Jan LeCun is someone that comes to mind. I had a number of professors that I think really supported me, and I was sort of an odd duck in the group. I think there were many full-time master's students in the program who were more recently out of college. I had been teaching for a number of years, so I was older and felt like I didn't have the same background as others. So I wouldn't say I was a standout student for my academic prowess, and more for the fact that I didn't really look or talk the part. But I think I brought a lot of enthusiasm to my coursework.
Well, you know, I tend to feel like classes where you have an entire homogeneous layer of students that have done nothing outside of university. You miss a lot that way. A lot of context never kind of makes it into the classroom. Nobody's seen the outside world.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it was interesting for me to form some relationships with students who were curious about those sort of things. So I had something to offer them in terms of, you know, my quote unquote real world experience, and that I was also just working full time during the process. And I think that was a good way for me to sort of break down some of those walls, is to you know, come at it from that angle.
See, you as a teacher, I assume, went through like a regular degree program, a teaching credential program, or something similar, you know, back before.
Well, I sort of conned my way into teaching as well. I think that's a theme in my career development. I joined a program that's still around. It's called Teach for America.
Yeah.
And this is a program that allows recent college graduates, typically recent college graduates, to go straight into the classroom after what I would describe as minimal training. I think that there is a real teacher shortage, a real need for motivated people to be in classrooms. And there especially is a need in urban and rural areas. And so my mother was a teacher, and I think, you know, my summer jobs were in camp counseling in high school and early college years. So I had I got a lot of joy out of being around the energy of young people. And I thought, this would be great for me to, Teach for America being a temporary program and providing some training along the way. I figured it would be quick, and it would be a way I could sort of give back before I decide what else I want to do with my life. And I did end up taking some courses while I was teaching, but I wouldn't say that I have any formal certificate or degree. And that can be dependent on the way that Teach for America has arranged with the states or the counties where teachers get placed. I think that depending on where you end up, if you are in Teach for America, there are different requirements. And being in Texas, I'd say the requirements were much more lax in that part of the country than say others, like maybe California or New York.
That makes sense. I actually grew up in Texas, so that sort of makes with what I remember.
That jives with your experience. Yeah.
Yeah, just so. Well, you know, you're a teacher, and you mentioned Lego Mindstorms, and so I was going to ask you about Seymour Papert. But if you haven't had a lot of formal teaching training, the name may not mean much.
I am familiar with Seymour Papert. I'm trying to remember the name of the book that he wrote.
Mindstorms.
Yep. So, yeah. Well, I guess that makes sense. But I do remember reading parts of that book, and that it was very much based on the concepts that learning is best done through projects and challenges. And I think it's very much an experiential theory of teaching and learning. And this is very much what Mindstorms the Lego version of Mindstorms tried to capture, right? So here's a challenge, you know, see if you can build a robot that will follow a black line on a white surface, right? And here are the pieces, and right. And so there may be some elements of some guided practice, but very much sort of the kind of learning where you're dropped in the deep end and you have to figure out how to float. And I think that's something that really resonated with me as a teacher. I sort of brought those basic ideas into my science teaching. We would, for example, I remember one of my favorite projects I would do every year was to challenge students to build a Rube Goldberg machine that would have to, you know, maybe like pour a glass of water, but they would have to introduce as many steps as possible. And we would talk about how simple machines, you know, a ball rolling down a ramp or, you know, some device that has a pulley that lifts something else up into the air. So the transfer of energy through simple machines to be able to achieve some kind of goal. I love these kind of projects because it forces students to think. They might not necessarily have a firm grasp of formal definitions, which perhaps isn't so important at the eighth grade level, but what they can do is apply concepts that they have somewhat of a loose grasp of, and by seeing the application, it forms some of those connections in their brain. And I think there's a lot to be said for how that can apply to, you know, the computer science topics that might not necessarily be top of mind in our daily software engineering roles. At least in my case, as a web developer primarily. But there are some, foundational ideas, and the application of those things can help, you know, develop the understanding of those. So I suppose it's just a long-winded way of saying I do a lot better when I, at understanding something when I go out and build it rather than read about the theory behind it and the formal definition.
The other thing I loved about that book was that when he invented the Logo programming language and the way he did it, it was very much designed to teach debugging as a not necessarily computer skill.
For sure. I think that's one of those intangible kind of skills that is perhaps formally described in our, or at least we are aware of what debugging is, and we give it a name and we have techniques to go about it when it comes to programs. But for sure, those kind of skills help when it's comes to, like, you know, you got to fix a leak in the house, or maybe even thinking through, I have a sticky relationship with a coworker, you know, how can I break this down into smaller pieces and figure out a way to go about the problem or try to solve the problem. So for sure, I love that that's another connection to how, some of this experience can help us better understand our world.
Well, so this method of getting into the profession, the combination of taking some classes, jumping in, sounds like a little bit of other self-study as well. How do you feel it prepared you for a job developing software?
You know, I think I wasn't prepared in the way that I knew everything I needed to know to write programs, but I do believe I was prepared in sort of an intangible way, in the sense that I very much have vivid memories of both my first day of teaching and my first day as a official software programmer. And I remember how terrified I was that first day of teaching. I actually almost fainted. I was so scared of these really tough looking eighth grade students looking at this very green, tall, gangly person who was obviously out of their depths. And I think that there was an element where I wasn't necessarily in the same, the stakes aren't quite as high as a software programmer. I suppose that when I have lives, it's, you know, people's well-being at stake as a teacher, there's definitely more consequence of falling down on the job. But I do remember that first day of my, I was working for a software consultancy, and I reported directly to the clients, you know, really big tech office with a lot of computers and a lot of folks that think to me, it felt like an intimidating atmosphere, and I'm supposed to go in there and be a consultant. I'm supposed to help them solve problems. And I obviously don't know what I'm doing. I think that my prior experience taught me, well, first of all, I survived that first day of teaching. It might not have been the world's greatest gift to teaching, and I think that I made a lot of mistakes, and I certainly but I can also say that I'm proud of what I accomplished with the tools that I had, and the experience leading into that, I think informed, you know, how we went about it. But
is it comforting to be able to look back more experience? And your current certainty that they had no idea what they were doing, did it?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's definitely part of it. I think that I've come to learn that most of us are figuring things out as we go. We're always, I think of that. We get promoted to our degree of incompetence, right? So I think that there's a point at which you've mastered everything you need to be good at what you're doing currently, but I think we're all sort of pushing forward to the next thing, and we're constantly in out of our depths, and I think that's part of I think that something can be very scary, right? Like going back to that first day of my software engineering job, I realized that I have the skills to figure out what I need to learn, right? And I think as we enter those situations more and more, we become more aware of the things that we don't know, right? So maybe that might be another way of saying the true value of my computer science education was I am more aware of the things that I think might not be on a daily basis impactful to how I do my job, but I have much more awareness of the boundaries of my knowledge and skills. And I think there's something comforting in that. I think we could perhaps have a false sense of confidence when we don't know what those boundaries are, and we're very comfortable with our current situation. And it can be something very uncomfortable about not knowing a bunch of things, but once you have developed an awareness of what you don't know, I think that, and that you realize that you have, whatever your background is, you have a certain degree, have an ability to navigate in that space and to grasp on to things, whether it be little by little or in big chunks, and to develop the comfort to be able to find your footing in that area. Like that, I realized that I wasn't going to become a master programmer in one day, right? Teaching was something that I had not mastered even in 5 years in the classroom, but I learned how to pick my battles, whether it be dealing with really difficult students or figuring out how to get the most out of a lesson plan. Like these are things that I had to build on year after year after year. And I think that the same is true of software engineering for sure. I've certainly feel like it's followed the same pattern where, there's no such thing as learn Java in 10 days, even though those were the books that I initially learned how to program. I think there's something more about learning how to be the best at what you do over the course of a lifetime, or as long as that you're in the field. And I think that's a lesson I've taken with me from those early days.
Certainly teachers who have been at it 30 years, the good ones are still learning.
For sure.
Yeah. If our profession turns out to have any real substance to it, it's going to have to be like that instead of like learn Java in 10 days. but I'm call it 30 years in at this point, and I'm definitely still learning things. So I think there's some substance. Cross my fingers.
I hope so.
Cool. Well, one of the things we talked about in our brief exchanges before the interview, kind of picking up topics, you talked a little bit about working on packaging.
Yeah, so I have, for some reason, I have ended up on a number of projects where I've had to help and also in the process learn how to bring, in a Rails environment, bring Webpack, which is a dependency bundler, in short, for JavaScript assets primarily. And so for developers who are familiar with Rails, we have something called the asset pipeline, and in Rails is beginning to adopt this new dependency management solution for JavaScript. And I think for those of us who've been in Rails for long enough, we know that there was a somewhat similar transition when we used to have to manage gems by hand in our Rails environment, and then Bundler came around and became sort of the de facto way we manage Ruby dependencies. Now, there's some interesting parallels between Bundler and Webpack in that both of them, underneath the hood, as I've come to learn, represent the dependencies as a graph. So there are a certain number of dependencies that are explicitly specified. It could be in the source code, or it could be something in like something like a gem file, but that each one of those dependencies that you've made explicit point to some other dependencies, and the whole set of that set of dependencies can be modeled either abstractly or in even in code as a set of nodes and a set of edges, an edge being something that points from one node to another. And I think because maybe more specifically about Webpack, that's a new concept, at least in JavaScript management for Rails developers, because the asset pipeline was not a dependency graph. And I think as we try to introduce this Webpack solution into a Rails environment, a lot of developers get tripped up about that. I think there's a lack of awareness of what the implications are for a dependency graph in managing the assets that get bundled as a byproduct of you know, deploying your application or using you know, the development environment to pull assets together. And I think I went into this initial project where I was basically tasked with, can you migrate all of our assets to Webpack, not knowing really what Webpack was and trying to sort of fumble through this. But I think once I understood that the dependencies were managed as a graph, it became much more clear why certain bugs would happen when I came in with the assumptions of how things worked with the asset pipeline, right? Those assumptions did not translate into a graph-based world. I think that most interesting, I think, sort of computer science topic that came out of this was the concept of topological sort. So once I realized that what we were dealing with was a graph, and I had gotten to a point where I'd set up the sort of base layer in a way that would make it easy to pull and migrate files from the asset pipeline to Webpack, what we wanted to do was update the syntax, right? So we have like CoffeeScript, and we wanted to write ES6 syntax. And we had hundreds of source code files. And the tough thing was, if we migrated one file that was really high up in the dependency chain, it wouldn't work, because the files that it depended on so lower down in the graph, hadn't been migrated, right? So what I realized what we, to be able to migrate things over in a fast way, I realized that, you know, I wanted to get the whole team involved. And what I wrote was a small Ruby script to parse all of our JavaScript files and figure out what other files does each one of these JavaScript files depend on, right? Because it's not explicit in the Rails asset pipeline. We had to, I invented sort of a ad hoc script to represent the dependencies. And so we had some conventions, right? We had like a way of specifying a piece of code that would be like our sort of hand-rolled module declaration. So each file would kind of have a function or an object that it would be responsible for defining, right? So each one of these files, though, might reference some object that by convention lived in some other file that had a naming convention. So we were lucky that we had some conventions that made this easier. What's interesting is the application of this process, I could use a library that's baked into, or I guess it's a something like a gem. It's baked into the standard library. It's called tsort in Ruby, and it's actually something used by the Bundler project as well to do the same sort of dependency graph resolution. But what you would get as a result was that if you can give this tsort module a list of nodes, which for this purpose would be a bunch of files that I had parsed from our JavaScript dependencies. And each one of those, think of it as a hash, and each one of those files has a list of other files that it depends on that I was able to, you know, ascertain through this initial parsing process and just hand it over to the tsort module. What it gives back is a ordered set of nodes such that I can tell for each file, you know, what order to migrate the files over to this new syntax would be, so that the application would continue working. I could verify that the application would work. So really what we wanted to do was start at the leaves of the tree or of the graph, so to speak, and migrate those files first. If I migrate a file with no dependencies, or a file where all its other dependencies have been migrated to that point, I can keep the application working and we can move things along. So it became a nice way of collaborating. Now I could give this list to my team and say, all right, here's the list of files we're going to migrate, and let's all contribute. And you just, when you're done, just let us know. And so we'll have a way of crashing on this migration. So as a group, we were able to, you know, small team of four or five, we were able to migrate, you know, hundreds of files within a day, because it was just became a very easy pass over following the order of operations, so to speak, that just this basic tsort function gave us. And tsort is what I believe is a implementation of a depth first search algorithm, such that it provides a way of traversing this graph in a way where for every given node, it understands the whatever computation needs to be made for its vertices first before doing the computation on the node itself. I guess knowing the intricacies of tsort isn't necessary really to be able to make use of it. But I think that just having that connection and that mental model coming in allowed me to realize just why this would be a useful thing and to turn into a practical activity for the team. And I think that was one of my favorite uses of tsort, and I don't think it comes up too often, but it was really useful at the time.
Yeah, tsort is a great example of something that I think I got through my entire undergrad comp sci degree without ever even knowing what it was.
yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think almost every application that I've seen of it in recent times has been some form of package manager management. And of course, that was part of the reason I suspect I didn't see it in my undergrad is package management, dependency manager, merely unknown graduated and, you know, now they're everywhere. And so it's just more important in the world now than it was when I graduated.
For sure. I think the aspect of, I think having at least a little bit of understanding what's happening under the hood, you know, given that many Ruby developers are using Bundler every day, many JavaScript developers are using some form of dependency graph to bundle assets. I think that at least having a mental model of what's happening under the hood, especially when things go wrong or when one needs to do something a bit, I suppose, unusual or out of the box. It's certainly, I think, a tool in the toolbox to leverage when the time comes up.
That makes a lot of sense. So you talked a little about intangible skills and you know, these things that you learned that weren't necessarily directly applicable to your job, but were more big things to know. And it sounds like with the topological sort, for instance, a lot of what you got out of it was the mental model, sort of the basic idea of what the activity was. And then once you got that general idea, sure, okay, you could know the implementation, but that's not the important sort of thing. Can you think of any other kind of intangible skills?
You know, I think one interesting story to share is I think the most impactful course that I took in my CS program, it was called heuristics. And I was interested in it first because of the stories I heard from students who had taken it. And most of them said, this is the hardest course that I've ever taken. And for some reason, that's been a motivator for me in the past. I think it's not the first time where I've taken a path where has been described in me, you know, like the path has been described to me in that way, right? Like, this is something that's really difficult and I'm better for it is sort of the implication, right? I think that really piqued my curiosity and I'm like, well, what can be so hard about this course that, you know, I know that these are difficult topics, but really, come on. But I think that there was an aspect like to describe just the way the course was run to help give a picture to that. So heuristics was focused on approximating solutions to complex computer science problems, right? So a famous one being the traveling salesman problem. So find the shortest path such that traveling salesman will visit a number of cities in their, you know, set. And I think that you can imagine that the solution to that problem would become, it would grow, like the ability to solve that problem would grow as the number of nodes in that set of cities, you know, that graph grows. I think
as far as computer science has ever discovered, that's an exponential time problem, which is to say that it keeps multiplying how hard it is every time you add a node to the total number you're playing with. 38
exactly.
nodes is a multiple of as hard as 37 nodes, and 39 is another multiple on top of 38. Yeah.
Right. So there is a solution to the problem, but it's can only be found in polynomial time, right?
Non-polynomial time.
Right.
There exists no polynomial. Yeah. There exists no time, no polynomial time solution. Every known solution is worse than any possible polynomial time. So it's worse than n to the fifth. It's worse than n to the seventh. It's worse than n to any finite number.
Thanks for the correction. And it showed the rust of my computer science training tends to show up at times like these. But
I have a weird finicky memory. Nobody remembers that stuff off the top of their head.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of the fun part. I guess a part of it is I know where to look up, you know, what I don't know when it comes to this stuff. But the interesting so the heuristics piece of this is, well, can we come up with algorithms And what algorithms have we discovered that can approximate these solutions in a much shorter time, right? So given that, you know, the solution to such problems becomes much harder to determine as the problem set or the problem area, the surface area grows, you know, what are some approximations? And I think that the challenge in this course was we needed to learn a new set of approximations every week. So things like evolutionary algorithms, genetic algorithms. So these are algorithms that are inspired by biological concepts, evolutionary being like you try a number of solutions and the fittest survives, and you take that fittest solution and you try a number of others and so on and so forth and repeat, rinse and repeat. Genetic algorithms, I think somewhat being like how modeling how, say, DNA might mutate over time. So making small changes might lead to, amongst a whole set of criteria, might lead to different outcomes. I think that some other problems approximations we might have would be in trying to figure out a way to model, say, a two-player game where there is some best move you can calculate in, say, chess or checkers or Connect Four, for example, where you can imagine there are a number of possible moves, and one of those might be the best, but I have to also make some kind of determination of what my opponent might do in their next move, which, based on the number of moves I could choose, they would have a number of moves that they could choose as a result. So looking into the future, right, is part of the conceptual piece there. I think there's some algorithms that come to mind would be like the min-max algorithm. So I would want to make my predictions based on what's going to be the maximum choice for myself, and then, but also think what's the minimum choice for myself, which would be the maximum choice for my opponent in their move. And you can probably guess with a fairly complex board, just like the traveling salesman problem, there's a growing set of possible moves to calculate into the future. The ability for that program to look into the future moves will degrade over time unless we have some ways to approximate. And so there's things like only going down certain branches of those decisions based on some criteria that would allow you to ignore the other set of solutions, right? So heuristics are based around these concepts that you might not get the exact answer, but you might be able to come pretty close to the right answer following some of these conceptual models of how you could construct an algorithm. And one of the challenges of this class is we had to internalize some set of algorithms every week. But we would also be tasked with every week writing and applying those algorithms or some subset of that the algorithms that we learned in a battlefield type of simulation. So every student would compete against other students. It would typically be staged as a multiplayer game. One student would have to create the game, and your program, you'd have to write a program every week that it would have to send messages to the game program over TCP and get messages back. So we would agree on some protocol, and it would give me, say, the state of the game now, and I would have to provide some move. You know, it might be a few examples, like imagine a seesaw with a number of weights hanging from it, and I want to remove weights from one side to cause it to tip over on my opponent's side, and they'll be doing the same. There's ways you can maybe predict using these algorithms. I think that the challenge was, you know, how do I write this program and actually apply these concepts? I at the time had just started my first Rails job, so I somewhat famously chose to write my programs in Ruby, which my professor discouraged because, you know, of course, the the knock on Ruby being slower than other languages. But I think ultimately some of these things, I suppose my programs tended to do fairly well. I think what was exciting to me was the fact that I was able to come up with some fairly decent solutions most of the time. I'm also proud of the fact that when it was my turn to be the game developer, I think folks typically would just have a non-graphical interface, right? It might provide some response and we would just sort of see a command line response, but I was able to build a web-based game. And so the game was represented, it was a competitive Sudoku game I had to author. And so we were able to compete over web sockets and humans could compete against the computers. It was something I was really proud of. But I think, that's the sort of the background of all that. I think what I take away from that course, and I think it sort of plays out in the fact that it was a rite of passage. And, I might not really need to know about evolutionary algorithms in my daily work but I think that, again, going back to sort of like, I was more aware of things that I didn't know at the time. Right. So I'm sort of expanding my surface area and ways to think about solving problems, right? And one big part of heuristics is making trade-offs, right? And I think without a doubt, something that I take to my daily work as a software engineer is having to evaluate trade-offs and be able to articulate what are the ramifications of making this choice versus some other choice to as far as implementing some business requirement, to provide my opinions on what those should be, and to be able to understand, both short-term and long-term benefits and costs of these choices. Having some programmatic ways to think about these problems, I think has perhaps, I think supplemented some of like the real world ways that I go about thinking about trade-offs. And I perhaps feel like that's the most helpful intangible that my computer science training has supported in my software engineering job. A lot of these like formal algorithms and definitions don't necessarily come up on a daily basis, but some of the application and we've talked about debugging, but certainly like when it comes to understanding and evaluating trade-offs and figuring out how to form opinions around these things is a big part of something that I've taken with me.
So what are you going to improve these days? I mean, you've been at the whole programming thing for a while, but do you just work at work, have some kind of extra outside work study? What do you do to improve?
To improve? I think one thing I've really enjoyed doing is writing, and I think this is another extension of this heuristics background, is I've really enjoyed making games with my free time when there's with what little there is, right? I still have a lot of interest in the web. I do like programming for the web outside of work, but I try to work on projects that I might not get to do on a daily basis. So things like playing with other languages and having real-time feedback is really interesting to me. So multiplayer games that folks can play over a network. Not really like interested in sophisticated graphics, but when I can like apply some fancy SVG technique, I think that's really exciting. One thing I did recently was a network driven Connect Four game, so that you and I could play through a sophisticated front end with animation and something to pass turns back and forth. I think there's some interesting challenges there, like how do you represent the board? How do you communicate that in real time? How do you evaluate the winner, right? So I think to be able to model the board, but also to be able to check each time a checker lands, have four in a row on a horizontal, vertical, or some diagonal been completed. Getting to use some different languages. So in that case, I built the backend in Elixir, which is sort of ideally suited for some of this real-time communication. There's fairly sophisticated frameworks there, namely Phoenix, to allow for communication over WebSockets, but the sort of the Elixir model of process-based execution, I think, is really interesting to me and well-suited for this kind of web-based implementation. I like doing practical projects, and typically it ends up being like, how do I do something like Connect Four or Battleship or some other multiplayer game that would force me to think through some small challenges around modeling and providing feedback and evaluating winners, things like that.
One thing that strikes me as you say that is I've always, in recent years when I've been good at this, I've been really careful to try and keep my programming outside of work and my programming, that I'm not getting paid for in any way, as different as possible from those other categories. I love rebuilding Rails. I love the book I wrote about yeah. Understanding Rails, etc. And when my job became a lot like that, doing the Rails performance stuff for AppFolio, I really had to cut back having that be my work time and my free time. It was just too much. And it had been a great free time project for years before. Not that I don't like it, and now that I don't work for AppFolio during the day anymore, now it's a good free time project again. It's just, you have to make sure there's some variety to it. You burn out pretty hard, or at least I do.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I try to be aware of that and sometimes wonder if my extracurricular programs, of that nature are even too closely aligned and broadening out, I think, would be definitely helpful for me.
I know I go by feel. Sometimes things that seem like they should be really close together, it's no problem, I can do both. Sometimes two things that seem really broadly apart, I suddenly discover, this is the same kind of not fun my job is. I don't want to do it anymore.
Right, exactly. I mean, I've also played with more functional-based languages. So, one thing I was introduced to in CS grad school were Lisp, having trouble saying that, Lisp-style languages. So Clojure is one that comes to mind that just is a totally different way of thinking about constructing programs that I think forces one to break out of the mold, right? So for maybe OO-based languages like Ruby, going with that mindset into Clojure is not going to be very helpful. But I think getting some foundation in those other sort of paradigms, I think also lets me think differently about how my Ruby programs are constructed and allows me to work some muscles that I don't get to work on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's neat working in other paradigms. Every so often I look at genuine weird, find a few languages that are intentionally... put it this way, if Emacs never got popular, using Emacs these days would be weird. It's still kind of weird.
Yeah.
But if there was not a whole, momentum behind Emacs over decades, you'd look at it and you'd say, what is this? What is any of this?
A good question to ask on a daily basis. What is any of this, for sure?
Oh, now we're getting into philosophy. I don't know. I always take a step back from that. I feel unqualified to do much philosophy.
As am I. I think, one other area that I have thought a lot about, which hasn't quite come up yet, but I do have a young son at home, and I would never want to force programming on him, but I feel like just given some of that, I suppose, education background of my own, I feel like that there is some value he could get out of it, and finding the right way to introduce him to it and perhaps elicit some curiosity, which may or may not stick, and I would accept whatever happens. But
How old is he?
He's 4 now.
Okay.
And so
that's early.
That's pretty early, and it's not something that is that I'm making any effort to introduce into his life. But
you probably know these, but two things I would highly recommend. So my kids are 2 and a half, so way too early, and 10 and 12. But think two things I would highly recommend you look into are Scratch and Human Resource Machine. Scratch you've probably seen before. It's Small Talk Under the Hood. It's a very solid one. It's a remarkably good thing. And in some ways, as a web presence, they go a step farther than GitHub into the whole social programming thing. It's a neat view at a different world. And you can see, you know, GitHub, for instance, trying to do it and never get it working in the same way. So yeah, Scratch is neat. Highly recommend. And the Human Resource Machine is far opposite in respect. If Scratch is take the things that kids actually want to do and make it easy to build those, Human Resource Machine is what's the friendliest face you can put on a low-level processor. It's good. It's done as a game. It's a good game. It will eventually get to be too much for your kid, regardless of what age you introduce them. I say this having, I mean, I got as far as building the binary sorts in lowest level assembly language without even multiplies, and I'll say, even if what you do is, you know, programming for a living, like that's a challenging thing. It takes some doing. There's a reason it didn't originally ship standard in a lot of the early standard libraries.
Right, right.
But yeah, Human Resource Machine is a surprisingly solid, good little processor emulator, and it's fun to play.
That one I had not heard of, so I will make note and take a look into that. Thank you.
It's the same people who do World of Goo, so it's little cheerful goth style. Yeah, and it looks like that.
Anything with World of Goo is something that we could use more of, for sure.
Well, you know, if you make it through the first Human Resource Machine and your kid's just blazing through it all, they make a sequel called 7 Billion Humans. And the idea is after the robot takeover of the world, you know, they're about to give people a utopia of idleness and artistic, you know, freedom. And people have no interest in that. They want jobs. And so as a human coordinator, you have to help the robots in finding jobs for all of these people. And so it's parallel processing, using a whole bunch of little people acting like processors.
Perfect. I think it's definitely something for adults, too, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's probably easier for adults than kids. But, I mean, with kids, trying to teach them programming, what you're looking for is something they like enough that they'll sit and grind on it for a really long time, right? You want something where they'll enjoy it and keep doing it. Because that's the hard part.
Right.
It is, I don't know, in my opinion. For adults, that's often the hard part, too. But, you know, for adults, you can at least say, you can get a job and make a lot of money. With kids, that doesn't really work. Like, if it's awful and they hate it, they're going to stop, even if you tell them it's for their own good.
Right. I think there's some aspect of there needing to be a carrot, which isn't necessarily like, hey, you'll get a job. But, like, there's something interesting here and something I'm curious about, and I want to get to that next phase to come see what comes next. And with programming, it can be really easy to get stuck and not want to, or not know what that next level could be. Like, it sounds like software like this is getting better at figuring out what is the progression, sort of to keep that encouragement and motivation going. So, you know, we don't get bogged down and get stuck, which can be a lot easy. Well, it can be tough for adults too, but certainly for kids learning something new like this.
Yeah, structuring an activity as a game can be a really powerful thing if you do it well. Software is complicated enough, it's hard to structure. We're getting to the point where we have some amount of ability to do that, and even some is a lot better than that. It's wonderful the amount of, you know, good research people are doing on games, you know, these days. What makes games fun and stuff like that.
Yeah, People a lot smarter than me, for sure.
I would probably say people a lot more specialized than you and me. It is kind of amazing how so much of this work, once you finally get to it and see what it means, doesn't necessarily require massive intelligence. A few fields early on, you know, do actually require massive intelligence. I'm amazed at some of the genius, no question. But most fields aren't like that. And most fields don't stay like that, even if they start like
that. Yeah, I think that there's that interesting question that, you know, we start asking ourselves is, you know, do I need to be more of a generalist or a specialist? You know, I think that there's that notion of being the T-shaped developer, where it's sort of trying to be a little bit of both, have some broad capability and depth in one area that seems to suit at least the story about what it means to be a web developer pretty well. But
With you, I can say, given that you've been at this a while and you're in programming terms an old guy, and I've certainly been at this a while, and I'm certainly in programming terms an old guy, we were doomed to become generalists. by this point, there was no question. Eventually, you wind up as a generalist.
Right.
So at least we know there's a long-term answer.
Right. That's the path we've been on, that's for sure.
Well, if you try to stay a specialist long enough, you eventually find yourself completely irrelevant, which is great if you can then retire. But if you're not, you know, done doing it, then you're going to have to learn one of these things that's still relevant to the kids. And by the kids, I mean anyone middle-aged or younger.
Right. There's that continually shifting curve of where to stay relevant that we have to be aware of. And, you know, I think those questions come up, especially for Rubyists, you know, in recent days as other technologies are taking shape. But, you know, as long as it's continues to be an area where I can find some employment and get some joy about it at the same time, I think that it's the right choice for me. But, you know, I have to continue to look ahead, and I see what you mean. That requires some, you know, continual reevaluation and constant learning, and at least awareness of new things that might be on the horizon, where you have to stay on that bubble to keep going.
As you say, employment is not going to just disappear. Like, there's going to be legacy Ruby apps. There just is. And it turns out their business niche is one that almost nobody wants to actually compete with. If what you're building is a small startup and your big risk is market risk, I don't think Ruby's going to stop adding projects. It certainly hasn't. I don't think it's going to. Just because nobody else wants to play in that playground. Like, who is trying to eat Rails lunch there? I'm not asking even who's succeeding at it. Who even seems to think that that's a lunch worth eating? It's a short list.
Right. Well, it's definitely been for me a nice blend of, like, the opportunity that has just been there. I've been drawn to that startup-y kind of environment, and the fact that Ruby has this element of focusing on developer happiness and being very expressive. I think just these elements that have brought me a lot of joy and the act of programming. So it keeps me interested in it. And I sometimes wonder if just like the elements of the language itself lead to certain choices as well in what, you know, what developers might decide to be the right technology, right? So, you know, the best tool for the job is sometimes a reflection of the developer's preferences and skills as much as any technical requirement, for sure.
Ruby is genuinely expressive in a way so English-like. You know, it's like if you learned every possible obscure word and figure of speech and then used them. That is, by any reasonable measure, a mistake. You should not do that. It is also, by any reasonable measure, a mistake in Ruby. You shouldn't do it in Ruby, which doesn't mean that either Ruby nor English shouldn't have all these weird quirks and corners. And that's actually one of the deeper games I'm specifically thinking.
For sure. I think what you're getting at is knowing when to use those tricks and the right time to use those when they have an application that is going to be the best way to approach a given problem. that requires some experience and some intuition to suss out. I don't think we have any formal, definitions or descriptions, right? When is metaprogramming or, reaching into the Ruby Eigen class going to be the best way of going about something? I think that developing that awareness of what these things are and some applications is the starting point, right? But being able to refine and make intelligent choices about applying those things. And when I say like in the professional setting, I think that's where the stakes are a little higher and other people are going to be responsible. Either currently or at some point in the future, or even myself in the future, having to come back and understand the layers in this area of the code base, being sort of mindful of those kinds of concerns when it comes to those tricks, right?
And so the question then becomes a lot more like the old questions. In an expressive human language, how do you put this together in a way that conveys your meaning well, but with the right kind and amount of ambiguity to other humans? And if you try and do that in computer spec language, you quickly discover that one, English is the wrong language to write a computer spec in, but two, computer spec language is completely the wrong language used to design an expressive human-to-human language, even if it happens to involve a computer reading it outside of that.
I think we're getting into some philosophical points again here.
See, I don't mind the kind of applied philosophy where you can check it and see if I'm wrong. I'm fine with that. My big problem where I have to worry about qualifications is when it stops being possible to simply check what I just said and see if it's wrong by trying it out. I'll philosophize all day as long as you can prove me wrong.
Right. What is all of this anyway, for sure?
Exactly. Yeah, that one's harder.
Yeah.
I don't know how to give a falsifiable answer for that without giving an obviously false answer for that. That's not it. Cool. So, you know you better than I do. You've been around you a fair bit.
I'd like to think so.
On this topic of getting an education in building software and taking it to a job and figuring out how well the education worked or didn't work, you've got some interesting, specific things in your story. I mean, you were a teacher before this. You know, you've got an unusual educational path. There's a lot of specific you interesting stuff there, which means it's extremely unlikely that I've asked the most interesting question you could be answering about that. What, there's some question that would have been the best question to ask, and I've probably missed it. I've just hit the basics. What do you think was the right question to ask you?
I guess the question of why. You know, I think that to me tends to be the most interesting question to start. You know, why are we doing this? You know, why? I think there's some aspect of motivations, like what is it that drives us that gets to the heart of the choices that we make? And I guess when I sort of reflect on my path, I sometimes still wonder why. Why in the world did I make these choices? And I suppose at every step of the way, I followed my curiosity and made choices that were more about what I was interested in at the time and interested in uncovering, and what I felt maybe deep frustration about not knowing and a deep desire to uncover. And that's kind of been my guiding light in a way, maybe without even being aware of it per se. I didn't choose to pursue a career in programming because I thought this would be the most lucrative job, or that I knew that, you know, software would have eventually start eating the world. I don't think that's the way we talked about tech back when I got interested in it. It was a big bust, economically speaking, in the early parts of the 2000s. I think I was very curious, though, and I suppose I don't know that that's a appropriate guiding principle for everyone, but I suppose in my case, I feel very fortunate that it's led me to along the path that I've led. And maybe I'm farther behind in some of the training of other, you know, developers my age, you know, who got started earlier, even as children. You know, I got into this relatively late compared to them, but I wouldn't trade the other experiences that I've had. And I suppose the aspect of staying true to that is something that I want to continue to hold on to as I move forward and pursue those opportunities that I'm most curious about. It served me well to this point. So I think I may as well stick with what's brought me here.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm pretty much your same generation. I got out of college in 98. And I've been a few more years, but very similar. It's interesting because there was our generation where it wasn't entirely clear you could go make a living programming at all, really.
Right.
And one of these days, I'm going to meet a bunch of people who got into it for the activism when it was already understood that would change the world and that you could make a bunch of money, but you should be very careful doing that. Might destroy the world doing it. And I don't know how I'm going to face those folks down. Channel Jeff Goldblum for a moment. You thought so much about whether you could do it, you didn't stop to think about whether you should do it.
Right. I think keeping in mind Jurassic Park and the, you know, potential dangers of following that sort of curiosity, I do try to be aware of that. I guess when I interact with, I would say, folks of the next generation, I do try to approach them with that respect for the fact that their motivations may be very different from mine, that they have very different experiences and were brought up in a different culture and mindset. And I think coming at that, I suppose maybe there's some divide there in the sense that I might not have come through the same path that they have gone through or have had the same motivations or the same context. But I think appreciating that what they have is a different perspective that I can learn from as much as I hope that they can learn from me has been maybe a helpful thought to keep in mind.
All right. So pretend for a moment that this conversation we just had gets wildly popular. People hear the episode. They love what you've had to say. They want to hear more from you. If this was a Twitter thread, it has just gone viral. You're going to post your SoundCloud. What's your SoundCloud? Where do you hope people go?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Rosta, R-O-S-S-T-A. And then that is also my website, rosta.net, where I write about Rails and JavaScript and other sorts of topics that interest me. Those are the two best places to find me.
That makes a lot of sense. All right. Well, this has been Noah Gibbs with Computer Science, Just the Useful Bits. And we've been here with Russ Kaffenberger. I think we've had a great conversation. I've certainly enjoyed it. Hope you have too.
I have. Thanks for having me on, Noah.